There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Pretty good crowd down here at Brasti this afternoon. A lot of sports watchers flocking in down here and watching a variety of sport, and more so than the Premier League. The Premier League is back after that international nonsense over the last couple of weeks. We are being treated to some of the, two of the most entertaining teams in the Premier League at the moment. It's been an entertaining first half.
It certainly has. No goals yet between Tottenham and Liverpool. 36 minutes on the clock, but it has. You're right, Tom. It's been a good game. Liverpool excellent in the opening 10 minutes or so. They actually had the ball in the back of the net. Roberto Firmino, it was, after just 35 seconds. It was marginally, probably called right in actual fact, having looked at the replays a couple of times. He was marginally offside. The linesman got it spot on and chalked the goal off. Spurs, though, have really come into this match. They're keeping their full-backs, Danny Rose and Kieran Trippier. They've reverted to a back four today, has Mauricio Pochettino. The full-backs are pushed on really high, and then in that middle of the park, Harry Winks adding a little bit of energy in there alongside Eric Dier and Moussa Dembele. They've got in and around Liverpool, and Liverpool have struggled to just keep hold of possession, or certainly certainly possession they would want to be holding in the final third. That really hasn't happened. I think Spurs have been good. They've grown into this match, so they have. It is still 0-0 though. We are still awaiting our opening goal of this one, but 37 minutes on the clock, it is Tottenham 0, Liverpool 0.
So we will keep an eye on that one for you throughout proceedings. Robbie Greenfield's with us here at the moment, and therefore it would be rude of us not to talk golf. It's a weird one at the moment, isn't it? Obviously there's some great tournaments ongoing at the moment, but there is something just on the horizon at the moment that everyone has one eye, one focus on, and that seems to be where all the conversations are leading, a certain cup.
Yes, a certain event that transcends the game of golf, and the Ryder Cup is just a couple of weeks away now, 28th to the 30th of September at the Club National in Paris, and I think we're really anticipating what should be an absorbing contest between, for me, the big favourites in America, who have probably the strongest team they've had since 1981. If you look at the makeup of the American team, Chris, there's, I think, 9 major champions, 2 players champions, and the current leader of the FedEx Cup point haul in Bryson DeChambeau. Europe, as solid as they are, now don't get me wrong,
they've got the world number one.
They've got the world number one in Justin Rose, who we'll hear from very shortly, but for me, their big guns aren't on big enough form right now, and I'm sorry, the likes of Tyrrell Hatton, the likes of Torbjørn Olesen, as good as they are, as solid as they are, they're not of the caliber of those American players. And I think there's been a sea change in this Ryder Cup, in the sense that I think that whereas Europe have always held all the cards when it comes to having team unity and a camaraderie among its own players, I think America now owns that camaraderie. And I have to break away because I think we've got a goal.
We do have a goal. There's a goal at Wembley, and it's gone the way of the away side, and lo and behold, I take him out of my fantasy football team, and he goes and scores. Jorginho Wijnaldum it is, who's been credited with the goal. It's Michael Oliver is the referee. He is saying that he has had the signal that the ball did cross the line. We're just seeing a replay of it now, and yet, sure enough, you can see there, it's a wonderful attempt by Michael Vorm, the Dutch goalkeeper, in for Hugo Lloris to keep this one out. He gets it all wrong in the first place. He can't get the ball clear. It's built in Holland, this goal. Vorm and Van Dijk, the two Dutchmen, they get involved in a little clash. He's got to do better there. He tries to punch this Vorm. It eventually finds its way to Wijnaldum. Fantastic header. Vorm gets back on the line. Can do not enough to keep the ball out. It does cross the line, and Liverpool have the lead. It's not pretty, but it's the lead. Tottenham 0, Liverpool 1. And
and to compound that issue, and I hate to dwell on your fantasy football team for any Liverpool or Spurs fans out listening there, but did you not just also play your wild card to take
him
out?
Yeah, I did. Thanks for that, Rob. Yeah, cheers. Jorginho Wijnaldum, first goal of the season.
Oh dear, that is why you should not play fantasy football, because it can ruin weekends, Tom, you stay well clear of it.
We will keep an eye on the football for you, but we were talking golf there as well. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I find it very difficult to find anyone that's giving Europe a chance at this Ryder Cup at the moment. A lot of people being very outspoken, talking up the Americans, but surely that's when the Europeans are at their most dangerous.
Traditionally, yes. Yeah, I would agree with you. And look, the writing is on the wall in the sense that it's not been... we haven't seen an American victory in Europe since 1993. So 25 years, that history, that record exists for a reason. The Americans don't travel so well. historically they haven't done very well on courses that the Europeans are able to set up to their own liking and to suit them and their players. And we've seen that as a result, you know, Europe have had an awful lot of success in America. They've been almost unbeatable, though, at home in the last sort of 25, 30 years or so. The difference for me now, this time around, is that it's actually Europe that has fallen into the trap of making it an old boys club, of Thomas Bjorn picking his mates and not really going with the form horses in the wild card picks. I defended his selections when he picked Henrik Stenson, Ian Poulter, and Paul Casey among
Sergio Garcia
as his four wild cards, as opposed to going to maybe a more informed player like Matthew Wallace, or a good friend of ours, Rafa Cabrera-Bello, can feel very hard done by that he didn't make the team. Garcia now has to go and perform, and we saw that with Darren Clark 2 years ago at Hazeltine, picking Lee Westwood as one of his wild cards. He picked his mate, and I think the Americans, when they, as much as we ridiculed it and we made fun of the fact they got this task force together and it was all very American in its processes, and you know they had a blue sky thinking meeting, and you know they had a real brainstorm, and they had a task force with committee members, and it was all faintly ludicrous, really. It was like, well, just pick a good captain and stop picking guys that last were relevant in golf 25 years ago would be a start. But you know, they got that right, and we saw they had the success, tremendous success, with Davis Love the second time around at Hazeltine. Jim Furyk, for me, is the ultimate, all you would want in an American captain. He was a bulldog as a player. He's tenacious. He's, to me, a bit like a Paul McGinley type character. He's very meticulous. He's very organized. And I worry a little bit about Europe this time around. I think the pendulum has swung significantly towards the US. Obviously, they had that comfortable win 2 years ago. The big challenge is, can they take that game abroad and win in Europe? But I think they're going to, Tom.
We have got the KLM on going at present. That's where a couple of the big guns are fine-tuning their Ryder Cup preparations. Any barnstormers in the first three rounds there?
Yeah, the third round is in progress, Tom. And no real Ryder Cup heroes or Ryder Cup stars at the top of that leaderboard. I think either they're playing in the Tour Championship over in the US, which is the finale of the PGA Tour, or they're taking some much-needed time off and preparing for Paris in their own time. But Jonathan Thompson is leading the KLM Open. You all shrug. I've not heard of him either. He is an Englishman. He is 13 under par. He's one shot ahead of Ashen Wu of China and Hideto Tanihara, not one of European Tour's most prestigious events, Jesse, it's fair to say. It has the look of a real Challenge Tour leaderboard, this. You've got Padraig Harrington up there at 9 under par. You've got a recent winner, Andrea Pavan, is also there at 8 under par. But it's not a big tournament, this, the KLM. It really suffers because of its scheduling alongside the Tour Championship and the finale of the FedEx Cup, which will take place next weekend. Bryson DeChambeau, of course, trying to convert a surprising lead in the FedEx Cup. I don't think anyone saw him coming from where he did to challenge. But Dustin Johnson, in case you might have noticed, has got other things to worry about than the FedEx Cup rankings. A very cryptic tweet posted on his timeline. I know you are an infernal gossip, Chris, so you will have been all over that.
All over it.
Paulina Gretzky, his other half, has deleted all photos of Dustin Johnson off her Twitter account, or sorry, her Instagram account. She's not on Twitter. Why would she be on Twitter? She's on Instagram, of course, where she can post photos of herself. But he's gone. He is. He's vanished, and he put up a very quick cryptic tweet the other day, did Dustin Johnson, insisting that they were still a family, that they were working through their problems together, and that's about it. He said every relationship goes through its ups and downs. Yep, thank you, DJ, for that wise counselling. But most importantly, we love each other very much and are committed to being a family. Thank you for your love and support. He doesn't mention her by name. I think that the inference is that it is Paulina and not anyone else in his life at the moment. But not ideal for DJ to be caught up in this, this situation. Heading into the Ryder Cup.
Yeah, they maybe take advantage of that. There might be some sledging to be done. Do you sledge in golf, Robbie? It's probably not the thing to do in the gentleman's game.
Well, the Ryder Cup, certainly the fans are not immune to sledging. I think the players generally try and keep things respectful. But over in the States, I think it's all fair game, isn't it?
It certainly is. Just one man. I just want to draw your attention to one man who is playing over at the KLM Open. And where, my goodness, where he has fallen to now. Martin Kaymer. How many majors has he won? Three? Two?
He has won two majors, a PGA and a US Open.
Two majors, sunk the winning putt, of course. And look at him now. no disrespect, he's playing Kale Open, of course. That's still a fantastic tournament that brings with it some great riches. But Martin Keimer's name, he's just fallen off a cliff this game, hasn't it?
Yeah, it can happen, and it has happened. He's not the first golfer to which it's happened either. I'll give you the example of David Duval, a world number one, and Martin Keimer, also a former world number one. So Luke Donald, another player who's really just fallen off a cliff. And as we, you know, as we acknowledge Justin Rose grinding it away and eventually getting to number one, I want to play out his interview that he did following that runner-up finish at the BMW Championship, if we can. But it's a reminder that it's a difficult game, and it is merciless. And when you're off form, sometimes in the search to recover that form, you can go down the wrong avenues and the wrong paths. And Martin Keimer's problems all started because he wanted to change his swing to do better at the Masters, and he wanted to be able to hit. You know, he built a very consistent game, hitting the ball a particular shape. He wanted to hit it the other way, a right to left shape, and in tinkering about with his swing, his form has completely deserted him. But a man who has finally reached the pinnacle of the game after 21 missed cuts as a pro. When he first turned professional, Justin Rose missed 21 cuts in a row, and now at the age of 38, he's world number one. This was his reaction.
Oh man, I mean, that's an amazing achievement. It's something I'm extraordinarily proud of. Obviously, you know, I'd love to have got there by winning, because that's what I've been saying for a while. I want to get to world number one by winning golf tournaments. And, you know, today was fun. I, you know, birdieing 16, 17. I knew Keegan was, you know, was ahead of me doing the same thing. So I kind of was responding really well. Hit a great putt in regulation, I felt, though, you know, that to win it. And then obviously just a poor playoff. Oh my God, just... you know, just was kind of glue coming out of that fringe there, and then I underread the putt a little bit, and is what it is. And you know, in a playoff, it's over before you know it. You know, obviously sudden death. But yeah, delighted to be world number one. It's boyhood dreams. You know what I mean?
Oh, it's a fabulous goal!
This is The Grill, live from Barasti, with more sport, the latest headlines, and top debate on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Half-time in the Premier League, no goals to report. One goal to report for you on that one. Technology coming to the fore, and it is Liverpool who lead.
It certainly is, yeah. Half-time at Wembley, Tottenham 0, Liverpool 1. Jorginho Wijnaldum it is with the opening goal. Michael Vorm, the deputy goalkeeper in for Hugo Lloris, of course, the skipper for Spurs. That is Hugo Lloris. Michael Vorm in, and he will not want to watch that again. It's a corner from the left-hand side, whipped in by James Milner. He's looking for Virgil van Dijk, the big Liverpool centre half. Michael Vorm comes, he tries to punch, just collect it. What is the fascination with goalkeepers and punching? I hate it. Me being a goalkeeper myself, if I was around and I spent a little bit more time honing said skills, then I could have played being maybe a Premier League goalkeeper. Oh, yeah. You've got to catch the ball, don't punch it all the time. He tries to punch it, he gets it all wrong, it spins off of his gloves. It's then headed clear by, I think it's Eric Dyer at
catching
the back post.
It brings its own risks.
Well, it does, but just be stronger and just go and claim it. This punching nonsense, it really does my... it does my head in. But anyway, the ball then falls to Jorginho Wijnaldum. He headers it back towards goal, and despite the fact Vorm makes up for it and produces a good save, by the time he does that, the ball's already crossed the line and Liverpool ahead. They weren't great, were Liverpool. I thought Spurs definitely came more into it as the half wore on, and probably marginally the better of the two teams. But the scoreline's important. It's Tottenham 0, Liverpool 1, and if that result stays the same, it will be 5 wins from 5 at the start of the season.
And learning to win ugly, Chris.
Indeed.
That's what we'll have seen. They did that against Leicester. They did it as well against...
Brighton.
Well, I suppose Crystal Palace.
Brighton.
They did it against Brighton, and they were efficient rather than brilliant against Crystal Palace, which is a ground that they've struggled to get good results at the past. So we're just seeing... You know, last year they were able to turn on the style and produce the fancy performances and put a lot of goals past teams, but they got tricked up in the fiddly games that they got a lot of draws last season.
Yeah, you're right.
And this season there's definitely been an evolution in this team. It looks like a grittier team that's capable of digging out results.
The start there as well, Jorginho Wijnaldum, his 19th Premier League goal for Liverpool and for Newcastle. Of course, he came into the league playing for Newcastle. That's the first time that he's scored away from home. So all of his goals, either St James's Park or Anfield, he can now add Wembley to the list as well.
Oh, what a venue.
You are listening to Dubai 103.8, listening to The Grill, live from Barasti, where the game is always on. Lots to look forward to throughout the rest of the afternoon and the evening when it comes to sport. One sport that has been on the front pages and the back pages pretty much throughout the entire week is, of course, tennis. And it seems that everybody who's ever picked up a racket or is currently plying their trade on tour has an opinion on Serena Williams. Britain's Jamie Murray has rejected claims of men being treated more leniently than women by umpires. Serena Williams docked a game by Carlos Ramos for verbal abuse during her US Open final defeat against Naomi Osaka. A week to the day, it was this time last week that we were talking about the final, not giving Osaka a chance. It was she that came out on top, but all the chat since then has been about Serena's outburst to the umpire. Was she within her own rights to do so? Was she not? Let's get the thoughts first and foremost to former British number one, Anne Kvyatkova.
The way Serena behaved, she was under a lot of pressure in that match. It wasn't going her way. She just couldn't let it go. And I do feel she went over the top. And I think sexism in tennis and across sport, it exists. So it's, you know, not beat around the bush about it. But in this particular case, you know, Carlos Ramos was doing his job. He's a strong umpire. He's respected by a lot of players, coaches, and other umpires. He is a guy that all the other umpires look up to because he's strong. He's consistently strong. And whether he's umpiring a men's match or a women's match, I think he treats them as individuals equally. But, you know, yeah, it has sparked an interesting debate, and I do think we have a bigger issue.
A debate that everyone's wading into, including Greg Rozetsky. If you need a quote, call Greg. What's he have to say on the matter?
It's kind of like a speeding ticket. You know, when you get caught for speeding, you know, you have to pay the ticket and you have to take the punishment. And that was the first warning. The second warning is an automatic when you break a racket. So that was the point at 15 love. And she'd been basically going after the chair umpire from one love in the second set all the way through to when she was down a break 4-3. So from my point of view, I think he did the right thing. You knew the referee was going to be very, very strong because of the fact of what happened with Nick Kyrgios earlier on in the tournament when, you know, he came off the chair, Mohamed Liani, and spoke to him and said, you know, I want you to do well, don't tank, make sure you give your best effort. And all the players were upset with that. So there was a strict law put in force for all the rest of the tournament where chair umpires weren't allowed to talk to players as well as following the code. And that's what Ramos did throughout the match. So, you know, I think all these claims of sexism and all these other things are just not justified. And I think if I look at it in retrospect, I would say Serena actually owes Naomi Osaka apology because she was the better player on the day. She would have won the match fair and square without all the hoopla. And I just feel sorry for Naomi Osaka.
Do Williams and the WTA have a point about umpires treating male and female players differently?
I think that's absolutely absurd, if I'm to be honest with you, because, you know, if you read the code, it says, you know, you cannot question the integrity of a chair umpire, sponsor of the events, and all sorts of areas like that. And she was basically saying he was a thief, he was a liar, he took points away from Ramos, and she never stopped. For me, it was more about the personalities. We've had John McEnroe being thrown out of the U.S. Open, Fabio Fognini last year thrown out of the U.S. Open for doing the same thing and getting the three code conducts as well. So, you know, this isn't just happening to male or female players.
So those are the thoughts of Greg Rozetsky, former British number one, giving his thoughts on the topic, as was Pat Cash, a former Grand Slam champion himself. He spoke to
us,
Chris and Robbie, earlier on in the week on Off Script. This is what he had to say about the subject.
There's nothing sexist about that at all. I don't know. I don't know if she claimed that or not. But look, the bottom line is that Serena overacted. She got falsely accused of something she didn't do, which was coaching, and that really upset her. And it just went. It got from, of course, then, you know, losing the match and being comprehensively beaten. Also, you know, just you know, added to the tension.
Those the thoughts of Pat Cash. So, fellas, we've had 7 days, or just under 7 days, just shy of 7 days to work this one out. Give me your thoughts on it now, Robbie Greenfield.
Oh, here we go. Settle in.
Well, okay. I mean, I was quite vocal about this during the week and in the aftermath, watching the final itself, I was kind of appalled at how people were reacting. I think there's a large swathe of people that follow Serena Williams and they view her as a real totem figure, which she is, and an agent of fighting for the, like a superhero, the suit that she wore in Paris, she very much embodies that. She is viewed as a heroine, a superhero of the world of tennis, and therefore can do no wrong in the eyes of her most ardent followers. And that extended to people like Billie Jean King, who were very quick to get on social media and say, yes, sexism is an issue, when I think the reality of the situation is that Williams acted like a spoilt brat who wasn't getting her own way. That is the reality. I understand that the smear on her character that was taken so personally when he gave the initial time violation. She was very impatiently berating him about taking that back and apologising. That seemed to be the root of it all. She should have just accepted that code violation. The coach did. He fessed up to it in the interview. He said, yep, I was coaching. My bad. Serena could have addressed that in the press conference and it wouldn't have been an issue. But then she brought her daughter into it. She brought sexism into it.
Her heritage.
She brought everything into it. And she made it an argument that it had nothing to do with. It wasn't an argument about sexism. Serena Williams, I understand, and like, I don't think, you know, growing up where she did, where she's come from, what she's achieved in the game, she's faced adversity down her entire life, and she is incredible. I mean, there's no denying it. She's an absolute inspiration to a lot of people, and she's the best female tennis player who's ever lived. No one's denying that. But that does not give her a right to behave like she did, and it wasn't champion behaviour. It wasn't respectful to Naomi Osaka. It was bratty, and it was spoiled, and that's the bottom line. She should apologise. She should reflect on this and actually come out and say, guys, I was in the wrong that night. I detracted from Naomi's big night, and I'm sorry. She won't do that because it's all about her, and that's the reality.
Yeah.
That's just who she is. It's all about her. It's Serena against the world.
It doesn't look like there's going to be an apology anytime soon as well, because we've sort of established battle lines now, haven't we? We've got all these people coming out with their opinions. The WTA has come out in support of Serena. The LTA has come out in support of the umpires and the line judges as well. And neither seems to want to budge on this one.
And that's exactly it. And again, I would direct you towards a piece, an op-ed piece that Martina Navratilova did in the New York, I think it's the New York Times, in which she gets it spot on. I think there's no denying that there is sexism exists within the sport. We just had to look a little few days before the incident at the Elise Cornet issue, whereby she couldn't take off her top. There was a rule there. It was a draconian rule. That was changed.
I agree with that, but male players get code violations more than female ones.
No, absolutely. Absolutely, Rob. But what I'm saying is that rule sparked, that row, Elise Cornet sparked a row that thankfully was changed. The rule was changed instantly. There was no, we'll review it after the tournament. No. It's a draconian rule. We'll change it now. So that's been changed. Martina Navratilova, though, her point was, yes, there are issues, but that does not allow Serena Williams. That is no excuse for the way that Serena Williams went about what she did to Carlos Ramos. She was accusing him of being a liar, of being a thief. She was questioning the reputation of an umpire, not just to the thousands in attendance, to the millions watching around the world.
And she must have been aware of that.
She knew what she was doing, and I would take it one
previous
step further.
She did it in 2009.
Kim Clijsters, with the line judge. And you'll never again be on my court.
That was the thing that got me.
That's the arrogance. That was the dripping in arrogance.
That was the line. You can make it. You can disagree with a decision. You can disagree with a violation and things like that. But when you use your position as a world number one, but more than that, a heroine in the United States, a great leader of women, someone who's, as you said, come up against adversity and overcome it. But you don't then say you will never be on another court, you will never officiate on a court that I step on ever again.
Who on earth are you to say that? Yeah, absolutely. Who on earth are you? And not only that, I would take it a step further. And it was just the way in which she was questioning. And Carlos got fed up. Carlos Ramos got fed up. He just said, you know what, you've called me a liar, you've called me a thief, so I'm going to take a game from you. And I would even take it a step further. I know it's a view that it's very hard to prove this view, and I'd love to speak to people in tennis about it over the coming weeks and months when I do see a few of the journalists when they come over. Part of me, she was frustrated because Naomi across the net was just that much better than her, and I have no doubt part of it was to try and upset the rhythm of Naomi Osaka. Part of it was to say, I need the crowd on my side here. I had hopes of winning a 24th Grand Slam title, and it's slipping away from me. and that didn't work. Naomi Osaka deserves all the credit, absolutely all the credit. She was a credit to herself, her family, her coaching team, because the way she handled herself and the way she played, Tom, a 20-year-old girl, 20-year-old woman, in her first Grand Slam final, she was magnificent, and she has taken an awful lot of plaudits for the way she handled herself.
Let's hear from her now, because she's been on the media tour afterwards. She was on the Ellen DeGeneres show as well, and she was asked frequently whether she was sad in the aftermath of that victory, given what happened. This was her response.
I don't feel sad because I wouldn't even know what I'm expected to feel, because I feel like since it was my first final and it was my first Grand Slam victory, overall I felt really happy, and I know that I accomplished a lot. And I don't think I even thought about feeling sad, because there's no experience for me to draw on any other Grand Slam final win.
Is she one for the future?
It's hard to say with women's tennis, because unquestionably she's great and she played brilliantly that week. But you know, we saw her in Dubai and she was knocked out in an early round. And she's 20 years of age, definitely. But there's such a competitive level playing field at the top of the women's game that I don't necessarily. She could be a Yelena Ostapenko who wins one and then doesn't do anything for a while, or she could start to put a genuine body of work together like a Muguruza or an Angelique Kerber. So she's definitely got a bundle of talent. She's a fantastic hitter from the back of the court, and she had the speed and the agility and actually the maturity to carry out a game plan. That was the other thing. What impressed me about her a lot was the fact that she wasn't ruffled by everything that was going on around her. And, you grow up when you play tennis your whole life to just learn to block out what your opponent's up to and all the histrionics on the other side of the net. But that being said, with the whole crowd's booing and there's just bedlam and pandemonium erupting in a 20,000-seater stadium around you, to stay in the moment and actually finish her off and not get dragged into that was I thought showed an incredible amount of maturity from her point of view.
It's going to be interesting. You mentioned the crowd there, and I think they played their part in this.
Oh,
you know, the cauldron effect that was emanating on that evening, and they were trying to influence the umpire as well in their own way. It's going to be interesting. I'm not sure where Serena's next scheduled appearance is, but it's going to be really interesting, the crowd reaction to her. Take her out the United States, take her away from the US Open, take her out the States. Is she going to come up against a little bit of criticism, possibly?
I think, sadly, I don't advocate that she should be booed or anything like that, but I think that her supporters are blindly loyal to her. And I would say, I didn't, you know, sitting and looking at the press conference and the sycophancy in the media, asking questions like, how much did motherhood enable you to comfort Naomi in that moment? I mean, come on, please. Hold her to some account. Ask the tough questions. None of the tennis media did. With respect, you could argue that the press who cover the Premier League are pretty good at asking some awkward and difficult questions and they don't fawn necessarily to some very powerful and influential figures like Jose Mourinho. There is too much fawning in tennis over people like Serena Williams, and that's not the purpose of the media. The purpose of the media is to ask the questions that need answering. Not one journalist in that press conference said, don't you think what you did was out of line? Not one. And that, to me, is incredible.
It was a strange... It was a bizarre game as well, wasn't it? Just from the off... The press conference at the end was bonkers. It was just a... It was a really, really strange game. And it's a shame as well that the US Open had to finish like that.
It's a strange tournament.
True.
38 degree temperatures. You had the
maybe that's why they all lost it.
It may be. Maybe, yeah. Global warming is the reason for this.
There's a sensational headline if ever there was
there
one.
There you go, yeah.
Global warming to blame for Serena Williams' meltdown.
Well, the current occupant of the White House would deny that. But yeah, look, I mean, it was a strange US Open. And on the men's side, I think... very much a return to the centre stage for Novak Djokovic. He was back, of course, in winning Wimbledon, but underlining the fact that I posited to Chris, who quickly poo-pooed the idea that Novak could actually still pose a threat to Roger Federer's 20 Grand Slam titles.
No.
Chris is shaking his head vociferously now, but I think he's the kind of guy that can win two or three a year at a good solid clip. And if he's able to do that for the next two or three years... he could close the gap.
I don't see Novak Djokovic reaching 20 Grand Slam titles. I really don't. I do question Novak. I'm not sure he is someone who has the appetite to go to 36, 37 years of
age.
Yeah,
I agree with that.
I think you're right. This is the third wave, the third coming, if you will, of Novak. 2011, 2015, I expect. Back end of this year, obviously, he's won Wimbledon in the US. I expect a big 2019 from him. Roger now, question marks, genuine question marks being asked after being beaten by John Millman over at the US Open, losing to Kevin Anderson, having led by 2-0 at Wimbledon. There are little cracks appearing perhaps there in Roger Federer.
I think the big thing as well about Novak is that he's obviously, you know, silenced a few of his demons. He's probably his own worst enemy to a certain degree, because he's got all the tricks, he's got all the shots, he's got the physique, he is the full package, but it's the mentality, and we know he's had his demons in recent years. He seems to have settled them. He came out with that bizarre press conference after talking about how he put it all down to a hiking trip with his wife. He went up one of the mountains in France or something, didn't he?
He's become a real
family.
He's become quite preachy, has Novak, and it's all lots of existential kind of philosophizing in his social media and his press conferences as well. And whatever works for the guy.
He's at the top of this thing with his wife. It was a 5-day hike, and he realised.
Well, he'd just been beaten by Manarino, in the French Open, and he went hiking in the French Alps, and apparently he gained some kind of clarity from that. And listen, if he feels he did, well, you look at his results subsequently. He went and won Queens. He beat Cilic at Queens, and then he was able to go on and win Wimbledon. I beg your pardon. I don't think he did win Queens, did he? He got beaten by Cilic in the final at Queens, but he was able to go on and win Wimbledon. And of course, what he did in New York is fresh in the memory. So, he's back at the top of the tree for me, and he's the man to beat in tennis. And it'll be interesting to see how the Rogers and the Raffas can respond to that challenge, and I am looking forward to 2019, because you've got to think that at some stage a Zverev or a Kyrgios or a team will make a major breakthrough and win a Grand Slam, and when that happens, the landscape in men's tennis will shift a little.
We are getting ready for pole qualifying. It gets underway at 5:00 local time here in the UAE. Pole qualifying for the Singapore Grand Prix tomorrow. So that will know who's on pole by the end of the show. We've also, of course, got Adam Bridge coming your way a little later on. He's going to pop in around about just after 5:00. And we're going to be talking to Jeff, aren't we?
To Jeff O'Brien, talking all things cycling.
That's all coming your way in just a few moments' time. But with the drivers getting ready to head out for pole qualifying between 5 and 6:00 this evening, let's just have a little look ahead to this weekend's Singapore Grand Prix.
Hello everybody, we're getting into the business end of the season now. 7 races left, and we're at the flyaway, the first of those here in Singapore. There's a cooling breeze today. The new double tier paddock buildings are on display, and it's been an eventful couple of weeks since we last saw you in Monza, Martin Brundle, and it's all happened at Ferrari. You called it out on air, you thought it might happen, but Charles Leclerc is confirmed as the second driver at Ferrari. Kimi Raikkonen moves on to Sauber. What do you make of that?
I'm very excited for Formula One, and Charles Leclerc, just 20 years of age, a lot of pressure on his shoulders, a lot of expectation. I think he'll do a great job there. There's a changing of the guard in Formula One, no doubt about it. Kimi, though, moves sideways, downstairs, which whatever you like to call it, and stays at 284 Grand Prix.
He wants his kid to see him driving, doesn't he? For a little bit longer so he remembers it.
Well, they might both be in Formula One together at this rate. So it is all changed, you know, and there are some very strong young drivers coming through. And I, for one, am very much looking forward to seeing Leclerc in the Ferrari. And it'll keep Sebastian Vettel on his toes as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Rubens Barrichello record of number of entrants probably on Kimi's mind, because he probably could achieve that in the next 2 years. What about Lando Norris joining Carlos Sainz at McLaren? Is that a good decision? Did you see that one coming?
Yeah, I think it makes sense. McLaren are in a restructuring phase, really. I'm a big fan of Carlos Sainz, more than most people, it must be said. I see a lot of potential in him when in the right environment, when he gets the right opportunity. He's like his dad. He's just got a winning mentality. His dad was a multiple rally champion, of course. Lando, I think the team had to put Lando in so he didn't go elsewhere. a lot to learn. Very young, of course. Great racecraft. I don't see him having any issues settling into Formula One in the long term.
Okay, with regards to the championship, 30 points separating Lewis Hamilton from Sebastian Vettel. We've got a lot to look forward to this weekend. And another reminder that three of the last four, since the turbo hybrid era, strangely, you think of Ferrari and Red Bull being strong here. Mercedes have won three of the last four.
They have, but they seem to struggle in terms of pace. They got lucky last year, of course, with the first corner crash. But this is pivotal. This is a must-win race, not only for Ferrari, but for Sebastian Vettel as well in the championship fight.
Goal, Premier League, Chris McCarty.
It could be game over at Wembley. It's Tottenham 0, Liverpool 2. So impressed with Liverpool. We're just talking off-air there again, underlining why I think they could go all the way and win a first league title since 1990 this season. Okay, we are only 4.5 games in to the new Premier League season, but there's a steeliness about this Liverpool team. It's Sadio Mane who does the damage down the left-hand side. He gets in behind the Spurs defence. He crosses it in. Jan Vertonghen is stretching. He ends up pushing the ball onto the post. The ball then rebounds out. Michael Vorm perhaps should have got there, but there is Roberto Firmino just basically on the goal line to sweep it home. It is Tottenham 0, Liverpool 2. Not been at their best, not at their fluent best today, Liverpool, but that isn't a bad thing, because when you're winning, when you're going to Wembley, you're defeating, and they certainly are at this stage, they're defeating one of their title rivals. That has the look of champions. And maybe, just maybe, I'm getting ahead of myself a little, but it is Tottenham 0, Liverpool 2. You cannot help but be impressed by what Jurgen Klopp and his boys are doing.
Mo Salah, slow start to the season?
A little bit, yeah. I think partly down to the fact that replicating what he did last year was an impossibility. He's not Lionel Messi at the end of the day. He's not Cristiano Ronaldo. He's still been great. He's still contributed to goals. He's still scored goals. He's still assisted goals. He's just taken a little bit more of a back seat. We've seen Firmino score now in successive games for Liverpool. Sadio Mane, as Chris mentioned, has been great as well. So I think we're going to see more of a shared split of the goals among those front three this season, and Salah a little quieter than he was last season. He was just in that purple patch, wasn't he, where he could do no wrong. That's not to say he won't get on the score sheet today, but certainly a little quieter than he was last season, Tom.
So if Liverpool continue this extraordinary form, Robbie, how are you and I going to cope towards the end of the season with this man and our colleague that we work alongside on a daily basis?
You should be worried about Danny Norton.
I just asked him, and Chris McCarty will be clinically depressed if Liverpool win this league.
Yes.
Is there any scenario in football that would depress you more, Chris?
No, absolutely not. Liverpool winning the Premier League is right up there for me for worst things that I do not want to
Liverpool
see happen.
Liverpool win the Premier League, Man City win the Champions League.
Oh, don't.
The last time you had
and Leeds get promoted back to the Premier League. That is the worst season. That is the season to end all
seasons. The triple threat.
Oh, can you imagine? Oh, literally.
You were a small boy the last time Liverpool won the league.
I was.
You were what, four?
Three. I was. Yeah, 3 years of age. 1990 they won it, so they would have won it in 1990. I was born, the August. I would have turned four, so I was three the last time.
So you do not have a living memory of Liverpool being league champions?
No, I do not. And I don't want to have a living memory, hopefully.
I think a lot of what you hear that comes out of the mouth of Chris McCarty, as a shrewd an observer of the game as he is, a lot of it, Tom, is the old reverse jinx. Talk them up. He did it for the Champions League final. I was saying Real Madrid all the way. He was talking Liverpool up. I know exactly why he was doing that, to ensure that they wouldn't win.
No, I am talking them up because I am impressed with them.
Impressed, but I think let's be real here. Manchester City are still the firm favourites. I know, we're all impressed.
They've gone to Leicester and won.
But you know that the team that I don't think people are talking about enough is Chelsea.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, I can only view on what I've seen of this Liverpool team. They've come on. They are maturing in the transfer market in the summer. Alisson in, Naby Keita in, Fabinho in. We've not even seen Fabinho yet. He'll get his chance, I'm sure, in the coming weeks. And then they go to Leicester, win. They've gone to Spurs, and after things stand, they've won. They've went and won. They're keeping clean sheets as well. Only an Alisson Becker mistake 2 weeks ago gave Leicester their goal. They haven't conceded properly, and since the season kicked off, they are looking
that.
Very, very good.
You listen to The Grill. We're broadcasting live from Barasta, where the game is always on. Liverpool's is very much Liverpool's game at the moment. Tottenham are ringing a few changes. We'll bring details of that in just a few moments' time.
Unbelievable goal!
The This is The Grill, live from Barasti, where the game is always on.
We're live from Barasti and we're marvelling at Liverpool's tactics.
Should have just been 3-0. It should have been. The game should be dead and buried. They have just played a beautiful move. The ball's fed into Roberto Firmino, who is, he's not a number 9, is he? He's one of those false number 9s, but what an incredibly effective player he is. He drops into his own half to get it. He spins it, spins around, plays the ball through to Sadio Mane. It's 3-on-2. He's got Mo Salah to the right. He's got Naby Keita, who's busting a gut to stick up with him. He gets into the penalty area. He could shoot, but he chooses to lay it off to Naby Keita. And in actual fact, it's a wonderful save from Michael Vorm to keep Spurs relevant in this game, because if that one had gone in, it would have definitely been game over. But 64 minutes on the clock, it remains Tottenham 0, Liverpool 2. And I will repeat, if this stays the way that it is, it will be 5 wins from 5 at the start of the season, 15 points for a rampant Liverpool.
Indeed it will. It's also finals day in the T20 action over in the UK. In fact, we've got cricket down here in Dubai. We'll get a score update on for you on that one in just a few minutes' time. But in the first of the semi-finals, the Vitality Blast, a T20's final day to be played at Edgbaston. A bit of a shock on the cards. Worcestershire Rapids, who are into the semis, into finals day for the very first time in their history, in the history of the tournament. They posted 169 for the loss of 6 wickets from their 20 overs. Lancashire Lightning, with all their big guns and stars, 147 for 9 with 4 balls remaining. They need 23 runs to win from 4 balls with just 1 wicket remaining. So it looks like Worcester will be going into their first final ever. What's happening down the road?
Yeah, down at Dubai International Cricket Stadium, game one this of the Asia Cup. Excited to see some of the world's best cricketers again coming here to the UAE. What I can tell you, match one, it is Bangladesh taking on Sri Lanka. A little earlier I told you that Bangladesh were 4 for the loss of 2 wickets. They've recovered well, have Bangladesh. They've moved on to 68 for 2 after 15.3 overs. Malinga it was who got the wickets of Das and Hassan, but Raheem and Mithun have stepped up. 25 not out for Raheem, 40 not out for Mithun. He's 40 not out from just 42 balls faced. So Bangladesh, they've moved on now to 70 for the loss of just those 2 wickets, making a recovery. Still a long way to go in this one. It is match one of the Asia Cup, which we will see in the coming days. India taking on Pakistan right here in Dubai.
Loads of cricket to look forward to here in the UAE in the coming months. In fact, we're coming into sort of the season now, aren't we? All sorts of events taking place.
Absolutely, yeah. We're midway through September. I always think October 1st is when the big events get underway, and delighted to be joined by one man who has added another fantastic event to the sporting calendar. He is the mastermind of it. He also has a day job as well. It is Jeff O'Brien from Onside Sports, as I keep a close eye on the football as well. It does remain Tottenham 0, Liverpool 2. But Jeff, welcome first and foremost to The Grill this afternoon. Always nice to have you on the show.
Chris, thanks very much. Look, I've been called a lot of things, but mastermind's not very often one of them.
Well, it is your
Let
baby.
Let me promise you that.
Well, let's talk about it, because we've put our name to it as well, the Dubai 103.8 UAE Road Cycling Championship. We spoke to you at length about it, the first edition, which was last year, Jeff. Changes afoot. It is a wonderful addition to the sporting calendar. More than that, though, it's a chance for cyclists to get a little bit of the column inches and a little bit of the limelight. Just talk to us about what happened in year one and the changes that you're making to year two.
Thank you. Year one was obviously to start something brand new is always a challenge. But we had some fantastic support from 103.8 and ARN. And we had great support from the local riders, which is obviously the most important thing. You know, without the local riders actually using that energy of something new and actually turning it into something that they want to turn up and be part of is really quite significant. We had quite a bit of feedback from all corners, whether it was sponsors, cyclists, the Federation, of course, who are our partner in delivering this national championship. And one of the things that we got from the cyclists was they wanted it to be more challenging. You know, the races were 65 kilometres or thereabouts last year, or last season, I should say. And so this year we've made it a little more challenging. And we've obviously increased the stages now from 2 to 4. What we're trying to achieve there is to give the local cyclists a bit of a grand tour experience. Yeah. And it's using all of the major disciplines that you see when you're watching the Vuelta at the moment in Spain.
I guess the trick for you, Jeff, and it is important that we point this out, there are an awful lot of people taking to the saddle, taking to their bikes. It's a huge, it's only growing here. But I guess the challenge for you is getting that balance right between giving your elite amateurs, and there are some wonderful talented cyclists here in this country, but it's also making sure that it is accessible for those that just want to have a bit of fun with it as well.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. One of the other things that we learned from earlier in the season when we ran this the first time was that the cyclists actually wanted this to be much more of a race.
Yeah.
So this is the national championships. It is a race. It's got some challenging routes now, and that was really part of the feedback that's actually started to, you know, define this championship. Because that when things begin, some of those waters are, you know, somewhat muddy, and we're looking to the market really to help us dictate exactly where this fits in. And the feedback that we're getting is, you know, we want a race, we want this to be challenging. We've got some incredible athletes, not just on the bikes, but you know, there's incredible athletes that live and ply their trade through here, and it's going to be a fantastic series. When we start on the 12th of October.
Jeff, I have downloaded my cycling app. I have been over to Al Qudra. I've very much got the bug. All we need now is to get Chris McCarty to at least verbally agree.
We need someone to find my bike first, Robbie.
I think that bike, you need to forget that one and look to the horizon for a fresh bike and a fresh challenge. But can what level are we talking about? Can absolute muggins like myself and Chris McCarty take part? Or is this very much... an elite level amateur event, Jeff?
I would say it's a competent level amateur event.
So no, then.
Definitely.
You said it in no uncertain terms, just nodding firmly at me to say no, you won't get anywhere near this event.
But also, just to put a little bit of a ring around that, when I say competent, you need to be able to ride in a peloton and feel comfortable.
That rules me out again.
Feel comfortable riding in a peloton. You know, we've got a sprint stage again this year, which is the Dubai Sports City stage. Once again, you need to be comfortable and in close encounters in close spaces when, you know, cyclists are traveling at somewhere around about 60 kilometers an hour, and to be able to handle yourself and your bike in a safe manner, you know, so it's
I'd be like the safety car in that environment, the one that slows everything down. Just
we can put you on
back.
The flags.
Yeah, that's 60 kilometres an hour is not in my wheelhouse. I know it is not in Chris McCarty's wheelhouse either.
Talk to us, in mine either.
Talk to us about, but you are a pretty competent cyclist. How has this event evolved? We had two roughly equivocal stages in Abu Dhabi and Dubai back in the first half of this year. There's now four stages. You've talked about a more challenging route. Have you introduced hilly topography to the route? Where are they going to be held, these stages?
Yeah, certainly. And that was really part of the key. What we're looking for, and I guess part of that, the answer to that comes out of the outcomes that we're trying to achieve. We're trying to find the best cyclist in the UAE in four major categories, being Emirati male, Emirati female, expatriate and male and female, which is open. We also have age divisions, 16 to 18, and then 18 to 21, and then 10 years up on each one of those. So we're actually trying to find the best cyclists within all of those different categories. So we need, we needed to make it a lot more challenging, and we have introduced hills. We're at the first stage is on the 12th of October. We're starting at Kalba and going through the hills of Kalba there, up through the two tunnels and back around. So that's going to be a challenging
route.
That's
where the mountain goats like Chris really come into their own, right?
Oh, look, he's built like a climber as well.
I am built like a climber, let me tell you, Jeff. I am not a climber. I think it would take me 2 days just to finish. How far is that opening?
77 kilometres.
77 kilometres. Okay, so we're in the hills of Kalba.
Jeff, how long would that take, just roughly? Would that be a two-hour race?
It's somewhere between 2:35, 2:45 to about 3 hours.
Okay.
I did that in 3 hours and 9 minutes last weekend.
Wow.
So it's going to be somewhere, you know, but there's a lot of people that are a lot quicker than me. So
Well, Jeff, listen, we're going to keep you, if that's okay. I know you're a busy man, but Jeff O'Brien is going to stay with us because I'm keen to know more about the other stages as well. It's just gone through 5 o'clock. Jeff is with us. If you've got a question, anything pertaining to cycling, Jeff is your man who can answer it on 4001.
Stay tuned. We have got our man, Mr. Bridge. He'll be live with us in just a few minutes' time as we build up to our 6 o'clock kickoff. Newcastle against Arsenal is your feature game here on Dubai Eye. We'll have news and thoughts and views from the commentator next.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.